I'm Captain Kevin Smith, and this is Throttle Up, a radio show and podcast dedicated to the proposition that critical thinking, when employed, can dramatically improve performance in whatever we are doing, enable us to solve problems that others avoid, equip us to become thought leaders instead of followers, and provide us with the intellectual resources and moral courage to support and defend America and its Constitution. Our motto is clarify, reason, win. That is, clarify the actual, employ analytic reason, and achieve mission success. Our website, throttleupradio.com, that has all kinds of information. Also, our podcast is located there, as well as iTunes. And of course, we have a blog, so please visit our website. Our support staff, Evergroove Studios for audio engineering services. They are located in Evergreen, Colorado, and Reflections Printing for multimedia support, and they are located in St. George, Utah. Our book is Critical Thinking Essentials, Quick Reference Handbook. It is available from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other outlets. Our broadcast time on Red State Talk Radio, we are on the weekends, both Saturday and Sunday, on the main channel, that's at 7 p.m., and the Encore channel, that's at 6 p.m. Okay, welcome back to another Throttle Up radio show and podcast. And this week, we are going to start, well, I guess you could say that we're going to continue. This is kind of a hybrid, and it's kind of a transition show, if you will. But we had been doing a series on how to think. Last week, we did the interrupted that for the presidential debate event, had some discussions about that, and now we're continuing in a certain sense. We are continuing our special editions, but now we are going to transition to a subset of how to think. And that subset of how to think is titled, we're going to give it a title, of course. And the title of that subset is going to be How to Decide. Now, there's a couple of reasons why we've decided to do that. There you go. And within the context of how to think, there are often opportunities, often challenges, often circumstances that will require us in some form or fashion to make a decision. And the what we're going through right now in this season, if you will, of this fall season of 2020, where we are now faced with another major national / international decision of who to vote for in this upcoming presidential election. We are faced with the, I guess you could say that we are faced with decision activities. We are faced with the certain periods and episodes in our life where we have come to a decision point. Often I use this decision node, if you will, but where choices have to be made amongst a set of competing choices, competing alternatives. In the world of decision theory, it's often called alternatives. Okay, sure, we can use that as well. What are the alternatives? Is this a foregone conclusion, or do we have to spend some quality time in this process of reasoning with respect to a choice activity, with respect to a decision challenge, if you will? Or the common term here is decision making, right? How do we make decisions? How do we decide when a decision is required? In other words, if we don't, the first order of business here is to ask ourselves, are we dealing with a linear world here? Is our model of reality linear, or is it nonlinear? If our model of reality is nonlinear, then we most likely will encounter at some point a place in which a decision needs to be made. And so we need to then engage in decision making as an activity. You can also say that during this period of the day, I am going to be engaged in a decision making initiative. Okay, so what am I talking about here? So we don't actually jump to conclusions. We spend some time, I call it some quality time, on this decision making process. If we are in fact involved in a decision making activity, then we need to spend some time on a decision making process. What is that process? And how should we go about performing this decision making activity? How should we prepare ourselves? How should we behave? How should we think? And what are the cognitive skills that we need to be aware of? What are the cognitive skills that we need to engage ourselves in? And so why am I doing that now? Well, it just occurred to me that one of our biggest challenges, if you will, or one of our greatest concerns is to be able to think for ourselves, okay, and not accept the conclusions that someone else has made. But to be skeptical, that is one of the five agreements in the five agreement books and ideas expressed by Dr. Ruiz. It started out as the four agreements, and then he added another one called the fifth agreement, and you can get that anywhere. And the fifth agreement talks about being skeptical. And I will read a few things related to that as we prepare ourselves to delve into this whole issue of how to decide. And I guess as we conduct our lives, as we engage in purposeful activities. And now keep in mind that, one of my emphases, the thing that I emphasize time and time again is that when we try to consider things that deal with our mental faculties, our cognitive attributes, how we think, what thinking is going on, what kind of reasoning. We need to look at it from the perspective of what is the frame of reference? What is the model of reality that we are engaged in, or that we have recognized that exists in our time and place here? What is it that is influencing us? What is it that is affecting us in all kinds of ways? So what are we doing in terms of human activities or behaviors? We have casual activities and we have purposeful activities. And so we are either doing stuff casually or we are doing things that has a definitive purpose. And purposeful activities propel society. Those are the activities that we would like to do if we intend to be productive. And so the purposeful activities are, and we should recognize what that, first of all, we should acknowledge that we are in fact engaged in a purposeful activity. And if we are engaged in a purposeful activity, is it a normal operation or is it a high stakes operation? And so we have, and those are the major decision points, as it turns out. Often they're not discussed at all. Neither is the fact that that all decisions are made within some kind of a superstructure or some kind of a model of reality. Is the environment benign, for example? Is the environment adverse? Conditions exist within the environment? Is the environment hostile? Okay, it's either benign or hostile, and then we have to make that judgment call. That's a key decision point going forward. And the other key decision point, which is almost always neglected, is that whatever I am building, whatever I'm designing, whatever I intend to bring to the marketplace, is it designed to work in a benign environment? Is it also designed to work in a hostile environment? In other words, is it resilient enough in order for it to perform well when the environment is less than benign? Or another way of saying that is that when the environment is hostile. Now, when I say hostile, it could be hostile because of adverse conditions. It could be hostile because of serious constraints. If you're walking across the desert and you don't have enough water to stay alive, you have then encountered a hostile environment. That's one example. Hostile environments could be because there are enemy forces out there that wish to do you harm. That's another example of a hostile environment, but not the only way to understand hostile environments with respect to, as opposed to, benign environments. Okay, so that's one of the keys here. All right, so why are we talking about this? The first order of business is that we have to consider, because we are bombarded by a whole bunch of information coming from sources that claim to be in the know, claim to be experts, claim to have inside knowledge, claim to be knowledgeable about certain things. The first order of business is for us to decide whether or not we want to agree with their position. I would suggest going forward that that's it's a major life decision. It's one of our key decision points going forward. It doesn't matter what you're doing, and this happens all the time. Should I believe, agree with, or acquiesce to that which is being proposed to me? Should I agree with that proposition? Should I agree with that assertion? Should I agree with that particular arrangement of cause and effect relationships? Should I agree with that equation? And those questions can go on for a long time, but they often are necessary for us. And so when we encounter that in our lives, we have to realize a couple of things. Number one is that if we are going to consider with respect to how to think, how to decide, if we are going to consider that as an important human activity that needs a certain level of consideration, that requires one to engage in certain kinds of reasoning, then, so the first order of business is to be skeptical. Okay, so in the book, the Fifth Agreement, I'm reading here from this book. I think it's important as we begin our discussion on how to decide. The first order of business, I think, is to be skeptical. The power of doubt. This is how the author, Dr. Don Miguel Ruiz, puts it. It's a practical guide to self-mastery. The fifth agreement is be skeptical, but learn to listen. Be skeptical because most of what you hear isn't true. You know that humans speak with symbols and that symbols aren't the truth. Symbols are only the truth because we agree, not because they are really the truth. But the second half of the agreement is learn to listen, and the reason is simple. When you learn to listen, you understand the meaning of the symbols that people are using. You understand their story, and the communication improves a lot. Then perhaps, instead of all the confusion among humans who inhabit the earth, there will be clarity. Once you realize that hardly anything you know through symbols is true, then be skeptical has a much bigger meaning. Be skeptical is masterful because it uses the power of doubt to discern the truth. Whenever you hear a message from yourself or from another, simply ask, is it truth or is it not truth? Is it or is it not a virtual reality? The doubt takes you behind the symbols and makes you responsible for every message you deliver and receive. Why would you want to invest your faith in any message that is not true? By being skeptical, you don't believe every message. You don't put your faith in symbols. And when your faith is not in symbols, your faith is in yourself. Then if faith is believing without a doubt, and doubt is not believing, be skeptical. Don't believe. And what you will not believe? Well, you will not believe all the stories that are created with our knowledge. You know that most of our knowledge isn't true. The whole symbology isn't true. So don't believe me. Don't believe yourself and don't believe anybody else. Okay, so that begins our journey into this arena, which we call how to decide. The first order of business is to acknowledge the fact that we are, in fact, going to receive information from others. We don't live in isolation. We're not a hermit living on the mountaintop. We live among others, and we are going to receive information from others. We are going to receive information in some form or fashion from the media outlets and other informational sources. And the first order of business is for us to decide whether or not we or one should believe such a thing, or should we be skeptical and not necessarily go along with what is being proposed? I would suggest that we develop what I call healthy skepticism. That's our first decision. As human beings, as thinking, cognitive, sentient human beings, I think that our first decision is maybe the most decision, but our first decision is whether or not something is believable, whether or not something ought to be believed, or whether or not we should engage our skepticism filter. I would say that is probably the most important decision that we will encounter in our lives. Now, within that backdrop, there's a backdrop here, okay, in terms of how to decide when it's appropriate to be skeptical of information that has come from other sources. There's a backdrop here. And the backdrop is this thing that has to do with knowing. This was developed by Donald Rumsfeld. It's becoming quite popular, and there are three aspects of it. The first one is to know what you know. The second aspect of it is to know what you don't know. And the third aspect of it is to be aware that you may not know what you don't know. Now, that right there, that's a pretty tricky thing. And it's not really well understood. It's not really well embraced by most humans. But here's where skepticism and a certain amount of intellectual humility comes to the fore. We have to, and that becomes our backdrop with respect to anything that we're doing, anything that we are thinking about. What do I know? What do I not know? And what are the things that I do not know that I don't know? There may be a whole bunch of things out there that has to do with that. And so that becomes our working model as we go forward in our discussions today about how to decide. Now, I'm going to put that within the context of something that we had been discussing, and it is not specifically related to our previous discussions, but it does have something to do with it. So I wanted to bring that in as we start our journey down this road that is called how to decide. And the context is, and the big picture is, the four pillars of a culture or a civilization. We discussed them previously in previous shows. And just for review, this is my take on it. The four pillars of any civilization are safety and security, prosperity. We could also say economy and prosperity. That's fine. The other one is the society and politics. That means how is the society organized? What ways have we organized ourselves to function within the context of a productive society, which is a system by which we engage one another for the mutual benefit of one another? And then finally, and this is the bit out of the box, finally, it's innovation and creativity. All societies are propelled forward by the ability to be innovative and creative. If we don't, then we're going to be stagnated. We have stagnant societies. They don't last for very long. The life of a stagnant society is very short. Not least of the fact is that it's because it is stagnant, it's not resilient. And so innovation and creativity and resilience go hand in glove. And that's what keeps us progressing. That's what keeps our productivity improving. That's what keeps our creativity flourishing, and so forth and so on. All right, so that's the big picture perspective on in terms of what are we trying to do here in our discussion. Now, the first order of business is to recognize that we are currently getting bombarded with a lot of stuff. A lot of information is coming our way. There seems to be a continuous stream of sensationalized material. It is constant. It's unrelenting. It is overwhelming in many cases. And the first thing we have to do ask ourselves, are we in control of our own destiny? If we are in control, then what is our decision right up front in terms of this bombardment of negative, sensationalized information? What is our decision? Do we actually believe it? Do we succumb to the negative effects? Are our emotions stirred up? Are we confused? Are we moving toward chaos? Those kinds of things we have to be aware of, and we have to make a decision. And it's often a daily decision. We have to decide whether or not we are going to, you know, open that email. We have to decide whether or not we are going to tune in this particular channel or this particular show. We have to make that decision up front. We have to say, I need to stay informed and stuff like that. Are you, in fact, staying informed? Maybe the way that you stay informed is to be your own curator of information and don't leave it up to others to do the curating. You can say, well, I'm too busy to be my own curator of information. I don't really have the time. I don't really have the energy. I'd like to know what other people are thinking. Okay, I would say that there's a certain amount of that that's probably okay, but I think it needs to be limited. So one of the decision points is, what what stuff out there am I going to access and what stuff out there am I not going to access? And here we're talking about a certain level of intellectual courage. We are discussing intellectual strength, if you will, and belief in one's own abilities, not succumbing to this authoritarian paradigm that wants you to believe that you and I are not quite smart enough to know this stuff, and so others are going to take care of us because they're smarter than we are. They are more informed. They have a better access to information. They are better funded, on and on and on. So we could say that we are our own sovereign individual self, and we have a responsibility as sovereign beings, or we can decide that we are not, in fact, sovereign. And so that's the key decision point that we are faced with. Now, okay, so I realize that I'm not giving you the decision processing model just yet, that I'm pointing out certain things in life in which decisions are necessary, in which the question of how to decide should be answered. I'm suggesting here that there are many places, and these are at the very, very highest level of our cognitive functionality, that decisions have to be made. We have to make these decisions. They have to be done on a daily basis. And that's one of the reasons why I'm starting this series on how to decide, is because I guess you could say that first and foremost, we humans, we are, from a cognitive standpoint, we are decision-making systems. We are intelligent systems that are able to and should be able to make decisions. So we have within ourselves the necessary decision-making apparatus by which we can make these crucial decisions, not make mistakes, and to maintain ourselves in a productive, meaningful livelihood, or in a productive, sustainable state. We are not going to go extinct as a species because we actually can make decisions. Okay, so that's the first order of business in terms of trying to understand ourselves and trying to understand what we ought to be considering as we move forward in this area that we call how to decide. Now, here's an example of what I'm talking about. In the first presidential debate, Joe Biden talked about methane with respect to climate change. Okay, so methane is a gas. He was very, very concerned, expressing deep concern about the existence of methane, the growing amount of methane in the atmosphere, suggesting that's a bad thing and suggesting that there is a scientific basis for our concern. So one of the things that we have as thinking human beings is that we have a decision to make right up front. And here's a perfect example Now, we're going to get involved in much more complex decision-making as we go through this series. But the first order of business is that now we have a decision right immediately. We decide whether or not this makes sense. We decide whether or not for us this is something that is believable, or we decide for ourselves and perhaps for our immediate group that we should be skeptical about this assertion and not necessarily believe it because we embrace the five agreements. We consider ourselves to be responsible for our own thoughts. We don't want others to plant thoughts in our brain. It's not a dumping ground for the thoughts of others. Okay, so what do we do with that? Well, we could do a little bit of investigation, or we could do a little bit of critical thinking here. We can say, okay, well, we're talking about the atmosphere. What is the atmosphere, first and foremost? Okay, good question. The atmosphere surrounds the planet Earth, and without atmosphere, we wouldn't exist, nor would anything else exist. So the atmosphere is a blanket of gases that protects the ability of this planet to support life. It's what supports life, primarily, not exclusively, but what supports life. Okay, so the atmosphere, and here this is not hard to find out, the atmosphere consists of the following. It consists of nitrogen, and the atmosphere contains 78% of the nitrogen. It contains 21% oxygen, and it contains 0.93% argon and 0.04% carbon dioxide. Also, it contains smaller amounts of other gases. It also contains about 1% water vapor. There are some trace gases in the atmosphere, but these are just traces of gases. They're very, very small in actual numbers and percentages and all of that stuff. Okay, fine. We have some trace gases that exists in the atmosphere, and they are carbon dioxide, CO2, that is a trace gas. Methane is a trace gas. Nitrous oxide, as well as ozone. Also, there are very, very small amounts of micro trace gases, and they are neon, helium, krypton, and xenon. Okay, so should we be concerned about methane? How much methane is in the atmosphere? How much methane can the atmosphere sustain? And will it have any detrimental effect if the methane increases by some definable measure? The answer to the question is, without going through a specific mathematical exercise that has to deal with metrics and other stuff, a matrix algebra is one of the ways that we can do it, but we don't have to do that right now, although there are some software programs that you could employ in this process. You might want to do that, but it does look like that methane, any increase in the amount, because it is such a small percentage of the atmosphere, it does not look like methane is going to have any detrimental effect whatsoever on anything, because it is such a minuscule amount anyway. When we're talking about traces, we're talking about something that is less than 1%, it is less than 0.1%. It is even less than 0.01%. So it is a very, very small microscopic amount that we're dealing with. Should we be concerned such that we hit the panic button because methane is reported to be increasing by a certain amount? I would say that my decision would be no. My decision with respect to the atmosphere and its climate change and global warming and stuff like that, it does not appear that methane is going to have any effect whatsoever on any of that stuff because it is such a minuscule part of the atmosphere. And how could it? How could even 100% increase in methane, given that it is probably, when we're talking about trace gases, was probably less than 0.1%. How could that have any meaningful effect on climate change? And the answer is it's impossible. Doesn't matter. Okay, so that's an example, all right, of what I'm talking about in terms of making a decision right up front, whether or not this assertion is believable. And let's just say for the moment that many of the things that we encounter will require us to make a decision right up front. It will require us to decide whether or not this piece of information is credible, whether or not I should be skeptical, and whether or not I should either reject it or put it in this file that's called uncertain. I'm uncertain about it. And now we turn to Jordan Peterson. He's got some things to say about what we are actually talking about. So this is pretty good stuff. And let me play this audio clip. Jordan Peterson is talking.
This is from 12 Rules for Life. Rule 4 is compare yourself to who you were yesterday, not to who someone else is today.
Yes.
Because you need to be, you need to have a hierarchy of improvement. You need to be aiming for something. And that means you're going to be lesser than people who've always already attained along that dimension.
Yes.
And that can give rise to envy. So the question is, who should you defeat in the final analysis? And the answer is you should defeat your former self. You should be constantly trying to do that. And you're the right control for yourself too, because you're the one who's had all your advantages and disadvantages. And so if you want to compete fairly with someone, then you should be competing with you. And it is the case, and this is what we were talking about too with regards to the self-improvement of the fighter, is, well, if you're improving yourself, then what you are doing is competing with your lesser self. And then you might also ask, well, what is that lesser self? And that lesser self would be resentful and bitter and aggressive and vengeance-seeking and all of those things that go along with having a negative moral character. And those are things that interfere with your ability to progress as you move forward through life. So it's very necessary to understand that this is why, you know, I've been stressing this idea of personal responsibility. It's like, well, personal responsibility is to compete with yourself, is to be slightly better than yourself the next day.
Yes.
And it better in some way that you can actually manage. And that's humility. It's right. Like, well, I'm a flawed person and I've got all my problems. Could I be as good as person X? It's like, not the right question. The right question is, could you be slightly better tomorrow than your currently flawed self? And the answer to that is, if you have enough humility to set the bar properly low, then you could be better tomorrow than you are today. Because what you also have to do is you have to say, well, here's all my flaws and my insufficiencies, and the best that someone that flawed and insufficient could do to improve and actually do it is this. And that's not worth going out in the street and celebrating with placards, you know. It's like, well, this is why I tell people to clean their room. So you're not going to brag to someone that you did that. But someone as insufficient as you might be able to manage it. And that means you actually are on the pathway to self-improvement and you're transcending your former self. And you might say, well, what's the right way of being in the world, if there is such a thing? And it's not acting according to a set of rules. It's attempting continually to transcend the flawed thing that you currently are. And what's so interesting about that is that the meaning in life is to be found in that pursuit. So I've been laying that out in these discussions too, because I say, well, the fundamental issue is that life is tragic and difficult, very tragic and difficult for everyone. And it's also tainted by malevolence, because no matter how things are tragic and difficult, but there's always some stupid thing that you could do or someone else could do that could make it even worse than it has to be. And so that's life. And you need an antidote to that, because that can embitter you. Constant contact with that. Just the tragedy, but the tragedy combined with betrayal and malevolence, that makes it even worse, especially if it's self-induced. Okay, so you need something to set against that so you don't get bitter and resentful. Well, what do you set against that? Doing something worthwhile, by your own definition, say. You need some reason to get the hell out of bed on a terrible day because you've got something good to do. Well, what's the best thing you can do? Transcend your current wretched and miserable self. There's meaning to be found in that, and real that's a meaning that's associated with responsibility. One of the things that I've been trying to lay out clearly is that life is hard. It's tainted by malevolence and betrayal. That can make you bitter. You need a meaning to offset that. Where's the meaning to be found? Not in rights, not in impulsive pleasure, but in responsibility. You take responsibility for yourself, so you take care of yourself. If you're good at it, you have some excess left over to take care of your damn family. If you're good at both of those, then you have some excess left over to take care of your community. Those are heavy burdens. You pick up the burdens. You find that's meaningful. The best way to pick up the burden is to continually improve yourself. And that's where the meaning is to be found. And so that meaning is in the continual self-transcendence. That's letting your old self die and the new self be reborn. Did you watch When We Were Kings? Ellie and Ali Frazier?
Yeah.
God, that's an amazing, amazing, amazing movie. Right at the end of it, so Ellie defeats Frazier, basically by letting him defeat himself, right? Because Frazier is angry and he's got a chip on his shoulder and he doesn't conduct the fight properly. So he exhausts himself chasing Ellie. And Ellie has basically just trained himself to take the damn blows, right? And to wear Frazier out. That's his plan. Then right at the end of the movie, he knocks Frazier down. And it's pretty much the end of the fight, but Frazier sort of struggles to his feet. You know, he's just getting up off the mat, and Ellie's got his hand pulled back to just nail him because he's completely laid open. And he puts his gloves down and turns away. That's the end of the fight. And Frazier said, and this is true as far as I know, that fight tamed him. Like, Frazier had a big chip on his shoulder, and he was a kind of a dreadful guy up till that fight. And afterwards, he was affable, and he was civilized. Ellie civilized him. And so, but that gesture that Ellie made was that great gesture, because he could have flattened him, right? And he had every reason to, man. He got taken apart. Ellie took punches like mad in that fight. And then in the final analysis, when he had Frazier down and he was struggling to his feet, he just let him go, man. Nobility of character right there. Something impressive to behold. So.
Why are you defining people, like, when you're saying this, why are you saying your miserable, wretched life? Because there's a lot of people that don't have miserable, wretched lives that also just want to improve. Like, why does it have to be the worst case scenario in order to
warrant improvement? Because it has to work. The theory has to work in the worst case scenario.
Okay.
That's
so
why.
You're using the worst case scenario as an example.
Yeah.
But do you think that perhaps may alienate someone who doesn't have the worst case scenario and just wants improvement?
No, I don't think so. Because, it depends on how much time you have to outline the ideas. But, mm-hmm. Because even if things are going really well for you now, there's going to be a time in the future where things are rough. You know, you're going to be ill. Family member's going to be ill. A dream is going to fall apart. You're going to be uncertain about your employment status. Like, the flood is coming, right? The apocalypse is coming. It's always the case in life. And you have to be prepared for it. And the question is how to prepare for it. And the answer to that is to find a way of being that works even under the direst of circumstances. That's the issue. And so you outline, and I am pessimistic about this in my approach in some sense, because when I'm talking to my audiences, and the same thing happened in my book, Maps of Meaning, and in 12 Rules for Life, I'm laying out the worst case scenario. And that's sort of like hell. It's things are going really badly for you. And that there's just chance associated with that sometimes. And you and the people around you are doing stupid things to make it worse. It's like, okay, what have you got under those circumstances? You've got the possibility to slowly raise yourself out of the mire. You've got the possibility to do just what the fighter does when he's defeated, which is to say, well, regardless of the circumstances that might have led to my defeat, like even if there were errors on the part of the referee, this is no time to whine about it. This is a time to take stock of what I did wrong so that I could improve it into the future. And that's the right attitude. You know, in the Old Testament, one of the things that's really interesting about the Old Testament stories is in the Old Testament, the Jews keep getting walloped by God. It's like they struggle up and make an empire, and then they just get walloped. And then it's all crushed, and they're out of it for generations. And then they struggle back up and make an empire, and then they get demolished again. And it happens over and over and over. And the attitude of the Old Testament Hebrews is, we must have made a mistake. It's never to shake their fist at the sky and curse fate. It's never that. The presupposition is, if things aren't working out, it's my fault. And that's a hell of a presupposition. And you might say, well, of course, you know, it's that underestimates the degree to which there's systemic oppression, et cetera, et cetera, and the vagaries of fate. It's like, it doesn't underestimate it. It's not the point. The point is, your best strategic position is, how am I insufficient and how can I rectify that? That's what you've got. And the thing is, you are insufficient and you could rectify it. Both of those are within your grasp if you aim low enough. One of the things.
Why do you see that? That's another thing you keep saying. Aim low enough. Have a low enough bar. Why do you mean that?
Well, let's say you've got a kid and you want the kid to improve. You don't set them a bar that's so high that it's impossible for them to attain it. You take a look at the kid and you think, okay, this kid's got this range of skill. Here's a challenge we can throw at him or her that exceeds their current level of skill, but gives them a reasonable probability of success. And so, like, I'm saying it tongue in cheek to some degree, you know, it's like, but I'm doing it as an aid to humility. It's like, well, I don't know how to start improving my life. Someone might say that. And I would say, well, you're not aiming low enough. There's something you could do that you are regarding as trivial that you could do, that you would do, that would result in an actual improvement. But it's not a big enough improvement for you, so you won't lower yourself enough to take the opportunity.
Incremental steps.
Yes.
And this is also what is achieved through exercise. It's one of the most important.
Yeah. Well, what do you do when you go and lift weights? Yeah. You don't go and, like, if you haven't bench pressed before, you don't put 400 pounds on the damn bar and drop the bar through your skull.
Right.
You know, you think, look, when I started working out when I was a kid, I was weighed about 130 pounds and I was 6'1". I was a thin kid and I smoked a lot. I wasn't in good shape. I wasn't in good physical shape. And I went to the gym and it was bloody embarrassing, you know, and people would come over and help me with the goddamn weights. Here's how you're supposed to use this. You know, it was humiliating. And maybe I was pressing 65 pounds or something at that point, you know, but what am I going to do? I'm going to lift up 150 pounds and injure myself right off the bat? No, I had to go in there and strip down and put my skinny goddamn self in front of the mirror and think, son of a bitch, there's all these monsters in the gym who've been lifting weights for 10 years, and I'm struggling to get 50 pounds off the bar. Tough luck for me. But I could lift 50 pounds, and it wasn't very, very long until I could lift 75. And, well, you know how it goes. And I never injured myself when I was weightlifting. And the reason for that was I never pushed myself past where I knew I could go. And I pushed myself a lot. You know, I gained 35 pounds of muscle in about 3 years in university. I kind of had to quit because I was eating so goddamn much I couldn't stand it. I was eating like 6 meals a day. It was just taking up too much time. But there's a humility in determining what it is that the wretched creature that you are can actually manage. Aim low. And I don't mean don't aim. And I don't mean don't aim up. But you have to accept the fact that you can set yourself a goal that you can attain. And there's not going to be much glory in it to begin with. Because if you're not in very good shape, the goal that you could attain tomorrow isn't very glorious.
Okay, we have run out of time, and we will see you all next week. Well, that went fast. So this is a close of another show, another Throttle Up. And before I go, I would like to acknowledge a few people. I'd like to thank my listening audience for being here, and I would like to thank Red State Talk Radio for providing us an opportunity for each and every weekend to put on this radio show that we call Throttle Up. And I would like to thank all of you veterans out there. Thank you for your service. And I would like to thank the families of the veterans. Thank you for supporting this noble cause. And I would like to thank all of you on active duty in the Guard and Reserve. Thank you for serving this great country of ours. And with that, I would like to say goodbye, and we will see you all again next week.